Hi, my name is Anne and I am an alcoholic.
I am.
I appreciate your reading and your introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to share my story. As that page 29 just said, right? How did I get this relationship, this thing of a higher power that I choose to call God? My sobriety date is August 6th, 2004. I have a home group. I have a job in that home group. I do that job in that home group to the best of my ability. I have a sponsor, and I have the honor and privilege of working with women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somewhat recently, we had a gathering at our home of the included my sponsor and the women that I work with and the women they work with and the women they work with. And there were six generations of women. And it gives me pause, you know, that gift of connection is what you taught me. The short story of Anne's drinking is I drank a lot and it was fun, know, and I drank a lot and I looked for the fun. I drank a lot and it wasn't fun, and then I just drank a lot. You know, I grew up in a church and I believed in God. I had a relationship with that God. You know, there's five of us in my family. We grew up in New York. And I, you know, we went to church every week, and my mom was probably more dedicated and connected to her faith than my dad was. We could get giggling in the pew, and you know, once one kid got going, the rest of us were gone for God only knows how long. But when my drinking took me to the place that it takes me and takes others, I need to ask for help. And my story is, right, I would have told you that my drinking enhanced my career, because in my mind it did. You know, I could belly up to the bar with the boys, and I could hang in with you. And again, I'm in New York, so we were bar drinkers. You know, none of this. When it came to Virginia, you have fake out bars. You know, like it's really a bar, but you have a restaurant, and you're supposed to have more, you know, on the ticket than meal and food than you are alcohol. Well, that's just silly, in my opinion. But you know, I could belly up with you. I could drink with you. I could slam them down. I was not a table dancer. I didn't slur my words. You know, I could hang with you, and I was proud of that. You know, I was proud of the fact that I would walk into a bar and they'd say, "Ann, Smirnoff and Diet Coke, right?" And that felt good. I felt like I belonged. I felt connected. And you know, not surprisingly, it caught up with me. Not surprisingly, it got to that point where my job, I believe my addictions come in a couple of different forms. I think as a kid, it was sugar was my original addiction. I struggle with that these days. And then alcohol was the acceptable mode in my family. I would say both my parents, you know, because I break the rules of AA and I'll judge and I'll say they both are alcoholic. My dad's death certificate confirms that. My mom, when she was dying last year, we went to visit her. She was in a place in Warrenton, and we went up there, and I said to one of the aides, you know, "Thanks for helping out my mom. Really appreciate, you know, being there for her." And she's like, "I'm really worried about her." And I said, "Why is that?" She goes, "She didn't even drink her wine today." The woman's 94. She had a prescription for 8 ounces of white wine at noon and 8 ounces of red wine at 8. And if she didn't get her wine on time, that woman had a cell phone. The only way she would make a phone call is if she was running low on her stuff. And what you taught me is I get to accept my mom for who she was. And I loved my mom to the day she died. And I was grateful to be present for her. You know, at one point in AA, I'm about to pick up a 1-year chip. And my parents by that time had retired. They're both teachers and they're living in North Carolina. And my mom drives up to my house in Richmond. And she, it, we were going up to New York for a baby shower, wedding shower. It was like a girl thing. So my dad wasn't there. And I have the opportunity to make amends to my mom. And I have this conversation and she's like, "Oh, honey, it's fine. Don't worry about it." She's kind of poo-pooing the whole thing. And I'm like, this is important to me. You know, I need to get all this stuff out because I was wrong. And, I'm not sorry I was wrong. And I don't like making amends today, right? I don't like admitting to the fact that I am wrong. But that has served me well. So I'm having this conversation with my mom and she's having a cocktail because that's what she does. You gotta love my mom. She brings it in a water bottle. She brings her vodka in a water bottle to put in my refrigerator. I'm like, "Mom, who are you hiding it from? You know, like I know you're drinking. It would be better for me to have it in a vodka bottle so that I know that it's the vodka as opposed to the water bottle because you're not fooling anybody." Be that as it may, she was, putting the E for effort. And so I make this amends and I said, I'd be curious, would you come to my home group and, let me pick up this white chip and would you be okay with coming to that? And she said, "Do you think they'll know I'm drinking?" And I said, "Mom, as soon as you get out of the car in the parking lot, they'll be all this. They will all know that you've had a cocktail." But that's okay. She came to my meeting. She got to see me pick up my white chip or my 1 year chip. And I'm grateful for that. But again, if I go back to my drinking, right? So I think my drinking is helping my career. It's not. I think my drinking is helping my relationships at home. It's not. I think my drinking is helping all sorts of things. It's not. But that's not how I see it. How I see it is that it's working for me. But I know that my life ain't working for me. So I go to a therapist. And I've been to this therapist before. And so she had a good sense of, kind of what my background was and where I was in terms of my lifestyle. And she is suggesting that maybe I don't drink. And I'm like, I am talking to you about relationship problems. I'm talking to you about work problems. I'm talking to you about stuff. And you want to get, and I didn't have the language that you taught me. And the language is, you're going to take my solution away. And I don't like that. But I can't use those words. I don't know those words at that time. I just know that I'm, very resistant to her suggestions. And she comes in, she's got a where and when, and she's like, "Oh, there's another professional woman who she said she could, I could give her phone number to you. And if you want to call her and blah, blah, blah." And I'm thinking, what a bunch of losers. Hello, AA, what are you kidding? My brother's an AA. I don't like him. My sister's an AA. She drinks all the time. There's, my experience with AA is not a positive one. And so I think the truth of it is that you scared me in that, I only picked up one white chip and I'm grateful for that. But I believe there were many white chips I would have picked up had I come in when I knew I should. Right? Because I always knew I was an alcoholic. That was never, we'd say, "Oh, I'm a functioning alcoholic. Oh, yeah, me and my drunk friends. Oh, I'm a bunch of drunks. But we're okay. We're hanging in there. I got a cool car. I got a nice house. I got a really big job. I wear big girl shoes. I have a briefcase. I have arrived." So don't tell me I'm an alcoholic, even though I know I am. So at this point, my job is, the infamous handwriting's on the wall. I know it's not good, and I better get out before I get kicked out. And so I'm going to interview with a couple of different companies, and one of them is in New York. And so I'm going to go see, and I'm going to spend a night with my sister, who's, kind of in and out of AA, but at that time I think she was sort of sober. And so I think I'd be safe at her house for a night. And then I'm going to stay with friends of mine for a night. And even though I drank with them as much as I drank with them before I moved to Virginia, I think I'll be okay for one night. Well, it turns out I can't stay with my sister. I have to stay with my friends for two nights. I do these interviews. It's the second day I'm there. We're now playing golf, and I say I'm not drinking. And we go back to the bar afterwards, and the bartender literally puts my drink on the bar and says, "Anne, it's good to see you back." I hadn't been back in I don't know how many years, and he remembers me. He remembers my drink. I mean, there was part of me that's kind of, well, that's pretty cool, right? I say, "Nope, just the Diet Coke, no vodka." And people look at me like I'm weird, and then we go to dinner, and I'm not drinking, and everything's fine. Well, now people know I'm in town. The word is out, and I haven't been home or back to New York in a minute. And so we go back to my friend's house, and people start trickling in, and one thing leads to another, and now there's 15 people, and all sorts of people are showing up, and one of my friend's moms shows up, and she walks in, and she says, "Anne, make me a drink." And to make Annie a drink was a position of honor. Because I don't know about the rest of you, but I did not let a lot of people make my drinks because they wouldn't do it right. I mean, if you pulled out that little shot glass to measure, dear Lord, it's going to be a bad drink. That's very clear to me right away. But Annie, I know how to make Annie's drink. I put a bunch of ice in it, I put a whole lot of vodka, and I open up the bottle of vermouth and I just sort of think about it. You don't pour any in, you just sort of think about it. I hand her this drink and I think to myself, why can't I have a drink? I've been a good girl all day. I have not had a drink. I'm not going anywhere. These are all my friends. They're all having a cocktail. Why can't I? I'm a clock watcher, right? I like those, that watch, that clock over there, big hand, little hand. There's a point in time I'm not quite sure which one is which. So I prefer digital clocks. Those I can register those in my little brain. So I know it was 8 o'clock. It started with an eight when I started to have my first cocktail that night. I know I went to bed and it started with a 10. So I was in bed before 11. Could have been 10:59. I don't know. It started with a 10. That's all I know. And I wake up the next morning and there's one there. It's a Friday. So they're going to work and somebody comes down and they're like, "Wow, Ann, how you doing?" I say, "I'm fine." They said, "Whew, I heard you fell last night." I said, "Oh, well, I'm good. I'm fine. All is well." They do their morning routine and they leave for work. And then the next person comes down. Now I have a little bit of information because I'm a blackout drinker, right? I know how to play this game. I know how to ask a question. I know how to pretend that I know when I have no recollection. So the next person comes down, gets a cup of coffee, and I said, "Boy, I guess I took a tumble last night." And she's like, "Oh my gosh, I cannot believe." They're like, "How are you?" And I say, "I'm good. I'm fine. Life is okay." She does her morning routine, goes to work. So now I'm in the house by myself, and I go to finish my coffee, and I'm going to take a shower. And it's a floor like this. It's a linoleum floor. And I walk into the shower and I start washing my hair, and the amount of gravel that's coming out of my hair is amazing to me. I have a bruise on my shoulder that's pretty raw. I have nothing on the palm of my hand, which leads me to, and I got a big bang on my head. I got a big knot on my head, and all this gravel. None of it fell on the linoleum floor, which is to this day, my hair was not this long then. It was much shorter. And I'm amazed that it didn't make a noise. And I get dressed and I think to myself, I believe I was standing straight up. And I believe I went straight down. And I think I hit my shoulder and my head. And I don't think I ever broke my fall. I've seen those people in sobriety. I've seen them over the years. I've never asked them because honestly, I don't really want to know. But that day, it's a summer day, it's August. I'm in upstate New York in the Albany area. If you've ever been there's no humidity. There's blue, blue sky, white, puffy clouds, green, green grass. And I can't see any of those colors. All I can do is sit at this porch and cry. And I'm like, I'm boohoo crying. I'm crying. And in that moment, I asked for help. I asked for help from this thing, not this God that I grew up in church, not this God that my mom has, not this God that was in catechism or any of this faith formation or any of those. I asked for help from this thing. I can't tell you what it was, but it was different. And it was different then, and it's different now. And I honestly don't remember a whole lot from the rest of that weekend. At some point in time, I got on a plane and I came back to Virginia. At some point in time, I went to that therapist on Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock, because that's what I did. And I told her a little bit of the story, because I lied to that woman. I paid her $100 an hour and I lied to her. And she said, "Well, how was your weekend?" And I was like, "Oh, it wasn't good." She said, "Did you drink?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And she said, "What are you going to do about that, Anne?" And I said, "I'm going to an AA meeting." And she says, "Why?" And in that moment, I say, for the first time, as our book talks about, I had to concede to my innermost self the fact that I was an alcoholic. And so I say to her, "Because I'm alcoholic." And that changed my life. And I came into that meeting, and the president of AA was standing up on the podium, and she was whacked. I mean, she had a tank top on that didn't belong out in public. She had shorts that revealed more than should be in public. She had tattoos from head to toe, and she told my story. I connected with her in a way that just surprised me. I could listen to what she had to say because it held a truth. It had depth and weight, is what our book talks about. And I got hooked in, and they said, this particular meeting, they read out of the big book, and then and they told a little, the chairperson told a little bit of a thing, and then they split up in groups. And so we split up in the group, and one person says, "You're a newcomer." And I'm thinking, "How do you know that?" Right? I now know, but I didn't know then, right? And I'm like, "Yeah." And he says, "Why are you here?" And I tell you the truth. I tell you the whole story. I tell you about the gravel in my hair. I tell you about the no scrape on my hand. I tell you about asking for help. I tell you the truth. Now that's a new experience. Because, Anne, I lie to you. I lie to you about everything. I lie to you about what I had for breakfast if I thought it served me well. You could care less what I had for breakfast. You're just making conversation, but I'm sizing you up, right? Because I lie about everything. And so I get into this gig, and you tell me about this service stuff, and I think, I do not want to clean ashtrays. I'm really clear about that. Like, I'm fine. I used to smoke, but nope, not interested. I think about it. I don't know about the rest of you. Again, bar drinker that I was. if you abused alcohol and you left some of it on in your glass, I felt the compelling need to help you out. And on my way out, I would finish everyone's drink. And I don't know about you, if you've ever had that experience, there's been more than one cigarette butt in my mouth. And I'm like, "Ah, man, I'm really not happy about that." But didn't stop me to pick up the next glass, right? Because somebody was abusing alcohol by not finishing their drink. So I came in, and you tell me to go to 90 and 90, and I don't want to go to 90 and 90. I'm a big girl. I got a big girl job. I got things to do. I'm very, very important. Just ask me. And the fact is, I had nothing. I had nowhere to go. I had nothing to do. I came home and I went to came home from work and I went to a meeting. And so that 90 and 90 gave me something to do. And for many of those days, I just went to a meeting because you told me, and I was checking a box. And it was a service commitment, let's call it. I wasn't listening so much, I was doing. You told me 90, so I was like 89, 88, 87. Somewhere along the line, I really wanted to drink. I know it was before I picked up a 90-day chip, and I really wanted that chip. A lot of meetings now give monthly chips. Those days it was, 30 days and 90 days. And so I was somewhere between 30 and 90 days, and I wanted that 90 day chip. And that stopped me from drinking that day. And somewhere along the line after that, meeting sort of became a place where I wanted to go, not that I had to go. And I started listening to what you had to say. I still lied to you when you invited me out to coffee, or you invited me out for breakfast, or invited me. I said, oh no, I got very, very important things to do. And I'd go home and I think, why did I lie about that? I think these people are actually nice. You kind of walked me out. You were weird. You hugged me. I was a hip checker. Like, oh, don't get too close, man. And today I walked in and I was like, oh, somebody said, oh, you're a hugger. And I'm like, oh, like I'm gonna lean in. I want to feel a hug, not a creepy hug, right? There's some creepy hugs, not a creepy hug, like a hug. And so one moment at a time, one day at a time, I didn't take a drink. And there were a couple of times early in sobriety that I had to count those moments. But I got to a place where, I was working with a sponsor, and she was a big book person. I'm a big book person. I work with people in this book, and we open it up before the chapter page. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I was taught in this page we lost the logo and the triangle and the circle because we're a good bunch of alcoholics and couldn't quite get that patented. And so we lost it. That's why it's not in. It's in the first and second editions, and not on the following ones. That's the story I tell. I don't know if that's true or not, but there it is. It's now in text, and therefore it's true. We'll put it on the internet, and then it'll become true. But I went through that big book with that sponsor, and she read it to me, and that annoyed me because I think to myself, my gosh, I am perfectly capable of reading a book. And I realize in going through that meetings with her that I was not, and she had a dictionary next to it. And to this day, now we have our phones and we can Google it, or we can chat GBT it, or we can, look it up pretty quickly. But in those days we had, Danny Webster was my best friend, and I have a book bag, if you will, with all my AA stuff and every single one of my fourth and fifth steps and 10th steps in there. And I have a dictionary because even as much as I had at that time went through that book with that first sponsor and have gone through this book with other people as I work the steps with them, there it's amazing. It's a magic book. I can open it up and I think I have read this page a lot. And there's a word I have no idea what it really means. And so this relationship with God, it kind of snuck in there. I'm 2 years sober, and for the first time in my life, I realized that it was God that took the obsession for me to drink away on that porch, because I haven't had a drink since. Hey, if you whip back the clock to January of 2004, right? I get sober in August. That whole 8 months, I'm not drinking. I told this therapist, "Okay, fine, screw you, lady." Fine, I won't drink if you think that's my problem. Fine, I dropped the pH bomb on you. And I can't. Come Wednesday or Thursday, I'm just going to have a little glass of wine. Come Friday, it's a weekend, I might as well. I'm going to see that woman on Monday, so I better not drink on Sunday too much. Right? Not drinking on Sunday is sacrilegious. And I don't know that I have a disease that has an allergy. I don't know that I have a disease that creates a craving. I don't know that I have a disease that has an obsession. And you taught me all of those things. And so when I go through this book and I have this spiritual experience, and all of a sudden, I realized, my gosh, that was God stopping me on that porch. And I thought I was Miss AA. Let me just tell you all the good things I'm doing. I had two people, I call them my parents in AA, Jack and Carol. And Carol, oh my God, she would slap me upside my head. And she's like, don't tell me how many people you're sponsoring. I could care less. Are you sober today? What you do for somebody? What you do for a newcomer? She'd slap me. She would never touch me like that. But I mean, she could do it with her words in a way that I got humbled, right? Because I have a big fat ego, and you humbled me. You right-sized me. You gave me a, you know, I didn't want to do stuff for you. That's not my intuitive thought. I had somebody call me and say, "Hey, my sponsor says your service job is to come pick me up and take me to a meeting." And I'm like, "No, thank you." What a gift that woman was in my life. I'd drive down 20 minutes south, go pick her up. She lived in a place that honestly I didn't want to. I was grateful that I didn't have to. And we'd drive 35 minutes up to this meeting. And then I'd drive her 35 minutes back, and I'd drive 20 minutes back to my house. And in that hour that I was in that car with that woman, I learned so much. She gave me such wisdom, such grace, such, you know, because she knew I was judging her. You know, I can hide it a little bit better these days, but generally speaking, you know, I'm gonna judge. What you taught me is keep it in my head. What you taught me is ask God to take it away. And it does. So I'm early in sobriety, and I'm finally asking God to help me. I'm finally asking God to do stuff for me that I can't do for myself. I'm sitting on a plane one day, and I used to fly from Richmond to Atlanta a lot. And so you fly a lot and you get bumped up to the big girl seats, and in the big girl seats, you get to drink for free. And so I've got this woman who's the flight attendant, and I'm pretty sure she must have been one of us. Because I would ask for my vodka and Diet Coke, and she would hand me four little airplane bottles, very, very discreetly. You know, like she'd set the one down on the thing, and then somehow she just kind of got it in my little seat. And I looked at her, and she looked at me. I smiled, she smiled, and I thought, this is, oh, life is pretty good, right? And so I'm on this plane, and I'm now sober, and now I'm not drinking. And the person next to me, the plane is taxiing, the person next to me has a drink, and the smell is overwhelming to me. I mean, it's just, it's all encompassing, and I can't get up, right? We're taxiing, and I'm in a plane. And so I'm thinking to myself, what do I do? And so I did what you told me. He told me to ask God to remove it. And I'm thinking to myself, that is not going to work. But you know what? I do it. And that smell went away. That person I believe had another drink, I never smelled it again. And that it was example after example after example of what my relationship started to build with this higher power who I now call God. In my job, I work with people, and a lot of times that's, you know, kind of a one-on-one conversation. And somebody's telling me, I don't even re remember what the topic was. And they're in my office, and we're kind of sitting in front of my desk, you know, because I didn't want to have like a desk between us. I just sort of make it a little more personal, intimate, if you will. And they say something to me, and I remember thinking to myself, I have no idea how to respond. I have nothing, and I'm a talker, and I am thinking to myself, what and how do I say? So again, I do what you suggested. So I say, God, can you help me out? And I swear there were words that came out of my mouth, and I'm almost looking at myself like a third person. And I can't remember what those words were, but I know they touched that person's heart. And my experience with God, when I ask for help, God's there 100% of the time. You know, my general nature is to be defiant. I got this. Okay, I'm an alcoholic. Fine. I'll ask for help on that obsession. Fine. I'll go to your meetings. Fine. I'll do what you're supposed to do. Fine. Got all that. I got all that. But on this thing over here, I'm good. I could take care of myself. I know how to do this. And then I fail miserably, right? I told you about sugar, man. I've gone through some stuff in my life where I think of Weight Watchers like I think of AA. You know, I'm going to go and I'm going to be a part of that because you taught me if I do what you suggest, then I'll get what you got. And I look around some of those rooms and I think I want what they have. When I think of AA and service, and I've sort of turned a chapter, you know, serving others in my home group, I get that. You know, being of service, somebody said, I was like young in sobriety, and they're like, Ann, just look at somebody in the eye. Just be nice to them. Go sit down. If they want to talk, let them talk. If they just want to be quiet, let them be quiet. Well, that's new experience for me, but I did it. Right? You come to my home group, you are going to be welcomed. You're going to be hugged a lot unless you tell us you don't want to be hugged. And services, you know, expanded to that. You know, working with others, I think is a service job. But last year I got to a place where I thought, you know, it's time for me to, I've got time on my hands. I've got change of job and I have time on my hands. And I joined GSR as an alternate. And I show up at that meeting every month and I listen. And I had judgment about GSR and I had judgment about how you ran the meetings and I had judgment about all sorts of things, none of which were realized when I went to the meeting. Because I was afraid you were going to start late and you were going to end late and you weren't going to manage the meeting and you weren't going to facilitate an agenda. And you, again, judge, 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 judge. And all of a sudden, none of those things. And it's a good meeting, it's people are dedicated. And you say, said I better get a service sponsor. I'd never heard of, I'm in this gig 20 years. I never heard of a service sponsor. So I have a prayer partner and we talk every morning and I'm like, what's this thing with a service sponsor? And she's like, you don't know? And I'm like embarrassed. No, I got nothing. I have no idea what you're talking about. And she said, are you okay with a guy? And I'm like, I don't care, you know? And so Jake and I have met, and the man is brilliant. He and I have been walking through the traditions, the way we walk through the steps, right? I'm going through the 12 and 12. My sponsor, she's a heretic. She uses the 12 and 12, not the big book. I'm amazed that I can actually, you know, love her the way I love her and keep her as my sponsor, despite the fact that she is not a big book thumper. And thank God she's not, because me reading the 12 and 12 has enhanced my sobriety tremendously. So this new service sponsorship relationship has been kind of fun. You know, there's things that I'm learning that I had no idea, and I'm curious about it, and I'm interested. And so I joined a committee, and in that committee, it turns out I, from a professional perspective, have a way to plug in and do something of service, and it feels right, and it feels good, and it's something I'm excited about, and it gives me, I don't know, energy and something I want to do. It's a little frustrating how, you know, unresponsive a bunch of people are, but be that as it may, I'm sort of, you know, like a dog with a bone. I'm pretty relentless. I'll just keep sending an email, making a phone call, and if you don't gonna answer my phone call, I'm gonna talk to somebody else. So service has been a really big, important part of my life. But the big thing that the big thing that you've done for me in the last 3 years is you taught me how to deal with ick in my life. Ick that I couldn't do anything about. We had a car accident. Car was trashed. And we walked away, right? All the airbags deploy. We're going 70 miles an hour and 395 coming out of DC on a Sunday at noon. And the car's totaled. And we walk out of the car, right? All the guys keep coming, and they're like going over 55 miles an hour, all airbags deployed. And we, the first responder, says, you should go to the hospital. And I'm thinking, we're okay. And Beth says, do you, what would you tell your mother? And he said, I tell my mom to get in the ambulance and go to the hospital. And so we do. We go to the hospital and we get a bunch of tests, and we, Beth has the presence of mind, as we're still in the car, to call our nephew, who we just spent the weekend with, to say, hey, we've been in a car accident. We're going to need a ride home from DC to Richmond. Like, I wasn't thinking about that. And over a series of events, it turns out I have a traumatic brain injury. And it comes out in, and this is a technical term, it comes out in assholeness. I have a very short fuse. And I cannot believe how stupid you are. And I look at you and I think, yesterday you weren't that stupid. And dear God, I have no patience for you. Not surprisingly, well, sequence of events. My old boss got fired. A week later, we have the car accident. So I get a new boss, and that guy doesn't like me because I am just a jerk to him. I'm just bad. So he fires me, and I'm aware in the back of my head, similar to that awareness of I was an alcoholic, that not having a job was going to be good for my brain. At that point, I'm not diagnosed with this traumatic brain injury. I don't know this. I just know I ain't right. I just kept saying, I ain't right. I can't think right. I'm mad. I'm mad all the time. I'm crying all the time. And I start to put into practice what you taught me. It's just recently that I've seen this. The accident was March of 22. So we're many years later, you know. And I went to PT, and they said, do this. And I said, I will. And I said, by the way, I'm an alcoholic in recovery. So tell me to just do this. Because if you tell me to do this, I think more is better. And at some point in time, Beth says to me, you know, when you do those exercises, do you get a little agitated? And I'm thinking to myself, what the pH are you asking? And I say, why do you ask? And she said, you seem a little agitated afterwards. So I go back to that PT, and she's like, Anne, I told you twice a day, not five times a day, twice a day. Once in the morning, once at night, that's all. And so I listened to you. I listened to my therapist the way I listened to you, because you taught me if I don't know, I think I do, and I don't. Right? I finally wrote the story, and it was an emotional roller coaster, and it was hard. It was hard to write the story. It was bringing up all this stuff. I had not one but four trauma therapists. The last one was actually a real trauma therapist and managed the trauma. And I've gone back to her, right? Just Friday was the first time I went to see her, in, I don't know, 7 or 8 months. And I learned how to live my life with this thing because of what you taught me, because of what AA has taught me. You know, I didn't want my disease. I didn't want alcoholism. It was a burden to me for a very long time. I was ashamed of it. I didn't wave a flag. I didn't have stickers on my water bottle that said sober life, because that would have been outing me in a way that I didn't want you to know about. And with this brain injury, you know, I'm not thrilled about it either. Scared me for many years that I thought, holy moly, is this all that Anne is? Is this where it is? Is this the person you wanted to, you know, be married? I don't, was not okay. But every single thing that you taught me about acceptance, I had to apply to myself, and I'm not very good at it, right? My sponsor and I have been working on it. I went through the steps last year and going through this whole writing of the story, and I was agitated at everybody. I was pissed at my sister, and I was pissed at my brother-in-law. And, you don't understand, judgment about everything. And she said, "Do a 10th step." And I'm like, "No, this is bigger than that. I know I got to do the step work." And so I went through this book again, and I went through it on my own. Not really, but she doesn't do the steps through the book, big book, and I didn't want to do it through the 12 and 12. And so I had a new experience because I was reading the words for me in a different way. I had a way to write in a way that was so cathartic and eye-opening and insightful. And it was an opportunity for me to connect with God in a way that I hadn't in the past. It was like, we talk about peeling the onion, and for me, it's almost just the opposite of layering on God's love in a way that I hadn't seen it in the past. I'm okay with the fact that I'm an alcoholic today. I'm okay with the fact that I'm in recovery. I'll probably tell you in short order, if you meet me in almost any environment, if I'm talking to you for more than an hour, you're going to know a whole lot about me, and you're probably going to know that I'm an alcoholic in recovery. That was not the case 15 years ago. That was not the case 20 years ago. So with this brain injury, acceptance is the key. I had to read that for, oh gosh, too many days. But it finally sunk in that I really do believe it. Am I thrilled about it? No. Do I want to fix myself? Yes. Do I want the magic formula of, I kept writing in my journal, just give me the friggin' steps. Tell me what to do, and I will do it. I want to get better. And the neuropsychologists and the neurologists and all the doctors basically said, and you're going to get to a point where you're going to get better fast, right? The first year, right? I couldn't comprehend. I could read, I couldn't comprehend. And today I can comprehend, I can read, and I know I have made changes. I know I am better. Things that I wasn't good at, I still am not good at. Maybe worse. I don't know, but you know what? It's not the end of the world, right? I am. I was never good at directions, and I still am not. My sister and I have lived in our respective homes for more than 20 years. And I'd sit in my driveway and I think, okay, how do I get to her house? And I was, you're not going to put on the GPS. I'm going to think and think. And I'd sit there and I'd say, all right, some point in time, I'm going to get on 522 because I don't like going 95, go the back roads. So at some point in time, I'm going to get on 522. All right, how do I get on 522? All right, I think I get it for off of 64. If I get off of 64, how do we get to 64? All right, it's 288. So I go. And I have to do that today. Is that the end of the world? Nobody died. So my brain doesn't work the way it used to. I am okay because that's what you taught me. You taught me to look myself in the mirror and like me for me. Because what's amazing, even when I know I don't like parts of me, because I know I don't like parts of me, you do. And that's kind of wonky, right? But that's God. That's God with skin on. That's God entering your life. If I believe that you're a child of God, then I'm a child of God. And if that's the case, then we're all children of God. And we've got that in us. And I believe that. I've always believed that there's good in us. That parable with the grandfather and the grandson, and which one do you feed, the good or the evil? And I believe that. So I want to feed the good because you teach me how to do that day in and day out. When we walked in, there was a conversation about relationships and using the traditions in relationships. And I shared that I had a love sponsor because when I got sober, I was in a relationship that was incredibly unhealthy. And I hadn't seen it until I saw it. And I was like, okay, so that's, and they said, don't change anything for that first year. And so it was like a year and 3 months, 4 months, and that relationship had, we'd separated. And that was a good thing. It was hard. It was icky. Any divorce you go through, it sucks, but it was the right thing. And then eventually I could get to a place where I thought, okay, I think I can start dating. I don't know how to do this. I've never dated. I mean, I got drunk with you. I slept with you, and then I lived with you for a decade. That was a very simple formula for me, right? It worked when, but not really. So I called you and I asked, and I had this friend who had been sober and met their spouse 5 years sober. And I thought, all right, I'm 4 years sober and I think I'm ready to date. And I listened to her, and she told me to do things that didn't make any sense. And she kept asking me a simple question: are you happy, Anne? Are you okay? And I'm like, yes, but, and she's like, but nothing. It's today. Where are your feet? You're fine. They're fine. You know, we didn't move, we didn't cohabitate until after 2 years. The cats moved in before they did, which worked out fine. Right? So I do what you do. I do it, you know, I have a this wheel of life, and part of this wheel of life is, you know, all my goals, and we were talking about goals and objectives, and I like those things. I like goals and objectives. And I didn't make up the wheel of life. You can Google it or ask Chat or Copilot or whomever AI form that you want. And it basically says what's important to Anne. And I got eight things that I think are important to me, and I have long and short-term goals that align with that. And I have a word for the year. And the word for the year in 2026 is powerless. And I'll be honest with you, I wasn't really thrilled about that word, but I knew it was right. You know, I kept trying to figure out what's the word of the year, and I would ask, you know, it's about this, and I had a sense of where I wanted to go directionally. And you know, if last year was a really around healing my brain, I kind of wanted to get my body back and, you know, physical health and whatever. But the answer is, you know, if I don't ask God to help me every single morning, every single prior to bite of food, I'll eat the sugar. I'll be defiant. Who cares? And then, like, my memories of drinking, I think, why did I do that? It's not serving me well. It's not helping me. So when I engage God, when I, you know, there are many phrases in the book that I always like, and one of them, you know, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. And that for me is pause and ask God for the right thought or action. And it worked for me in those conversations with people at work. It's worked for me with conversations at a fourth and a fifth step. It's worked for me in so many circumstances with people in the grocery store, with my spouse at home, with every single part. If I can just pause and ask for help, better things happen. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you told me I was going to have to change everything, and I didn't believe you. And you know what? Everything changed for the better. This relationship with God that I have is a gift. You know, when I think back of the conversations that Beth and I had early in our relationship when we were dating, and I said something to the effect of, you know, like, why do you like me? You're like, why do you like me? And she said, you have an amazing faith. And I'm thinking, you don't like my cool car? You don't like my really nice big house? You don't like my salary? Like, come on, let's talk about the stuff. She didn't care about that. And that to me is what it's all about. My relationship with God is an incredibly important, intimate, personal relationship. It's the thing that makes all things well. It's when I'm on that beam, when I am connected, when I feel that strength and that power, I know I can get whatever done, done. When things are crunchy and they don't work, and they're, you know, we were trying to make a flight reservation at one point in time, and it was hard. It was just like hard. I'm like, we need to stop because this isn't supposed to happen. This is too hard. Because you taught me when it's really that hard, it ain't right. I appreciate the opportunity to share my story. Thanks for letting me share.
Yeah.